Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back. I'm Carmack, and this is Combat Chronicles. Loads to talk about today because we've had a UFC pay-per-view, obviously, goes without saying. That's why you're here. You want to hear all my thoughts on that card. And, well, it was a mixed bag, really, wasn't it? I think I'm going to be forced to talk about a women's flyweight title fight, which, if you listen to the midweek podcast, not something I particularly like doing, but this one at least holds some intrigue. But, yeah, UFC 285 is mainly the story of the return of John Jones, which, as I say, on the midweek podcast, I had a lot to talk about regarding that fight, and still got a lot to talk about it now. Certain questions were answered that I floated in that midweek show. If you haven't listened to it, I'm not going to force you to, but the sort of short of it was, is the John Jones we saw at 205 going to show up? The sort of impotent grappler, poor kickboxer, just sort of tanking it based on the fact he's got a great chin and can walk you down and just fiddle his way through the fight, which someone took umbrage with and said, you should have a bit more respect for John Jones. And I'm calling that how I see it. What part of me talking about how great John Jones was in his prime and how he slipped in terms of how he approaches the sport of MMA and the differences between how great he was in his prime and what we've seen in recent fights is not giving him credit. To just say, oh, well, he used to be great, so I'm still going to say he's great now, that's just having low standards. Not going to do that. But yeah, John Jones, he didn't look too great physically. I actually recorded the... I recorded the midweek podcast before the first... I think it was like the same night I dropped it. They dropped the sort of promotional shot of Jones. Looked like he had a bit of a gut. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, all right. Not really certain that John Jones has approached this like I thought he was going to. Just a bad angle, because at the weigh-in, he looked good. And in the fight, his back looked humongous. He didn't look like body beautiful or anything, but he looked a big, strong heavyweight. Like 245 pounds, I think he was. 240 pounds. That's a great weight. That's more than fucking like Stipe Miocic in his prime, you know what I mean? Or thereabouts. He looked big and strong. He looked good. But yeah, I'm getting sidetracked somewhat. The fight. Let's talk about it. Thoughts going in. Could John Jones recapture any of his sort of previous form? Could Cyril Garn do what he needed to do and not shit the bed? That was my big criticism of Garn against Ngannou, that essentially he shit the bed. Was it going to be that due to the lack of power from John Jones, he's not a big puncher by any means, that Cyril Garn wouldn't shit the bed? It turns out that it was the wrestling that made him shit the bed and he was absolutely awful. Now, Garn has some talent, there can be no doubt about it. His talent would be better suited to glory kickboxing, in my opinion. But don't think, or maybe something like, you know, Rising, you know, you'd be fine, like, stomping people's heads out. Because they've got, like, an absolutely woeful heavyweight division. But, yeah, in terms of MMA, Cyril Garn, everything I heard about him, and I think I spoke about this in the podcast, but everything I'd seen and everything I'd heard, just, I didn't see the hype. Liked him more going into the Ngannou fight than I have done subsequent to that. People go, oh, having a close fight with Ngannou, that's good. Do you know what I mean? He had a really close fight with him. Yeah, he did. He did. And Ngannou with one leg, who out-wrestled him. And, you know, Garn made bad, this bad IQ demonstrated in that fight. That's what worries me. It's the bad IQ. You can be the immense athlete that he is at heavyweight, and he absolutely is, and have the striking ability that he has, and he absolutely has it. And you can be still relatively young in your career, and I'll give you some sort of dispensation for that, and I'll, you know, make allowances for the fact that you're not quite there yet. But when you hear the stories, and I think he said it himself, that, you know, essentially he doesn't go to the gym unless he's got a fight booked. That's a guy who doesn't want to learn. That's a guy who doesn't want to progress. That's a guy who will never progress. That's a mentality thing. And when you see him make bad decisions in fights, yes, that will come with experience, but it's also got to be down to mentality to some extent. And when I see him capitulate like he did against John Jones in this fight, which I'm going to get to, I promise, that's a mentality thing. Stick a fork in him. You might think I'm being sort of harsh, unfair to Garnier. He's gone up against the hardest puncher in MMA and one of the all-time greats. And in both fights, lost to a varying degree of awfulness. But, you know, there's certain things that just don't sit well with me. Jones, you know, pressured him, and it's Garn's lack of knowledge that causes him to be so easily pressured. He wants to concede ground and therefore get further, closer back to that fence, because he knows he lacks the acumen to deal with Jones's grappling. I mean, can't get overlooks. He ain't got a clue. Completely woeful. And Jones practically kicks him straight away, giving him something to think about. There was a point where I guarded him with a sort of rear side body kick, and I thought, oh, here we go. There's something here. Not the low blow. But I thought, oh, there's something here. Here we go. That's good, you know. But he's just conceding ground too much. There was a point where he was in Southpaw, and I think I made this point when I spoke about Garnet and Garnet back when I did the preview last year. Was it last year? Yeah. Of course it was last year, but was it last year or the year before? My podcast wasn't even running the year before, so it's definitely last year. Where I said, Garnet's just more, he's more comfortable kicking out of one stance and jabbing out of the other, and he jabbed in the Southpaw stance here, and he jabbed low, he jabbed to the body and drew a reaction. Jones parried the shot, reached down to parry the shot. Wasn't trying to grab the wrist or anything, which is what Jones does brilliantly, of course. He's so good with that sort of long guard and using it to hand fight, of pull his opponent in for knees or to close the distance or use that to transition to the body lock, etc. And it's all things that he does great. But in this, he wasn't. He was parrying. Garn, he jabs low, doesn't land anything. Jones sort of parries it or bats it away. And Garn just backs off. Now, drawing that reaction, sharp mind, and a sharper mind than me, obviously, but, you know, I'm from the outside looking in. That's all this podcast is. I'm not saying I'll do better than him. I'm a little fat guy who hasn't been in a gym for years. Garn would knock me out with a look. So don't get on your eye horse, but he's drawn a reaction and done nothing to follow it up. Now, I wouldn't be too bothered about that if he's just trying to get reads, etc. But what he does after that is he jabs low, Jones parries, there's no follow-up despite that hand being low. So he knows straight away, oh, okay, if I jab low again, I can then turn that over upstairs and hit him right up, because when I jab low, Jones drops his left hand, okay? Garn doesn't do that. He immediately retreats and then shoots a backhand with no setup whatsoever, off balance, goes over his lead leg. Jones ducks underneath, gets a body lock, and from there it's basically over. Jones puts all his weight on Garn, drags him down, attacks posts, and then when he gets him in this occasion, it looks like Garn might be able to wall walk. He just gets him in a front choke, and it's over, basically. He just taps out with little resistance. And again, this can seem like I'm being really unfair on Garn. You know, yeah, it must be horrible to have John Jones on top here putting the squeeze on. I absolutely agree, but he capitulated. Really, really easy. John Jones looked surprised at how easy it was. And the reason I'm saying this and being so unfair, and it is unfair, I know it's quite harsh, but it's not unfair. No, it's harsh. It's not unfair, but it is quite blunt. It's because Garn made Jones look better than Reyes, Santos, Smith did. You know, where he looked really shot as a fighter. Jones tried to show a bit of his dynamism. He sort of, what did he do? Did he miss a kick and then, or something, but then he sort of went for the spin and he kind of, it was quite seamless in the spin, but he did look kind of silly. Old burly bloke doing that doesn't look as cool when the kind of lanky arachnid Jones was doing it when he was fast as fuck back in the day. But okay, tried to spin. It's what I wanted on the midweek podcast. I see a return to the old Jones. But the fact that Garn made it easy for Jones to do what he struggled so badly against those guys. I mean, I did a right or robbery on the Patreon about the Reyes fight. Took him four rounds to even try and grapple him. And even then, Reyes was able to fight grips, you know, get overhooks, fight Jones off relatively easily, considering it's John Jones. Garn just fell a bit quite easily against the biggest and most likely strongest fella John Jones ever faced. I mean, DC is stupidly, you know, DC's the strongest fella he's faced. And he fucking wrestle fucked him in their first fight. That's the incredible John Jones. I said that in the podcast last week. That's the John Jones. That's the real prime John Jones. Garn made him look closer to that than any of those light heavyweights did. And those are flawed light heavyweights. It's not like, I mean, I've spoken before, you know, Jan Blachowicz is flawed. Ankalaev's flawed. It's not like they're a murderer's row either. The fact that, you know, it's Reyes, Santos, Smith, who have varying levels of ability. I'm not just going to be one of these online guys that are like, heavyweight shit, they're all shit. But in the, you know, actual facts of it, they have varying levels of ability. And they all made John Jones look pretty bad. Cyril Garn made John Jones look a lot better. Now, there's a couple of things I did touch on in last week's pod. I hate to keep referring to it, but I will. For the uninitiated who haven't had a chance to listen to that one, I thought that John Jones might be liberated without the weight cut. I think that's clear to see. I thought that might make him less sluggish. I think that's clear to see. He was more proactive, just seemed a bit more with it. Even at the weigh-in, I thought this guy looks so confident. He must feel good in himself, and he must look at Garn and go, this guy's got nothing for me. And essentially, that's what it is. This idea that this fight is some huge legacy builder. John Jones, he's won two bouts. Unless you maintain that Garn was so badly robbed against Ngannou that he is the rightful champion, which I could see. If you're going to make that case, make it. Don't tell me that just for winning this bout, which essentially is a vacant or interim bout, against a fighter as flawed as Garn, or the idea, the notion that all number one contenders are built the same. So Garn is the number one ranked heavyweight. What a win. What a legacy builder. Well, the number one ranked heavyweight, who we've got previous tape on not looking all that brilliant. I mean, I don't think he looked particularly good against Volkov. I don't think he looked particularly good. I mean, the tie two of us are amazing how he turned it around, but it's not like he didn't get dropped by him. And like I say, he looked weird against Ngannou. It's not the same as, I don't know. I mean, we had a fight last month that was a bigger legacy builder. Makhachev versus Volkanovski. That's a fucking legacy builder. John Jones beating someone who's nowhere near as good as he is at MMA, that's not a huge legacy builder. It's good that he beat a ranked heavyweight. Very much happy. If he'd done that when heavyweight was last good, you know, in the Velasquez, Verdum, Miocic sort of time, now we'd be talking about a GOAT contender. This whole thing that John Jones has now come back and proved himself, without a shadow of a doubt, the greatest of all time, doesn't really sit that well with me, considering we just saw, and hey, hear me out. This is not the same as McGregor knocking out Aldo that quickly. Because that's a guy winning a striking battle. We know that's a great striker. John Jones easily outgrappling a guy who's terrible at grappling is not that impressive to me. And I've actually pushed back against the notion before that, and I just used McGregor Aldo as an example, that dominant wins should be discounted because the loser doesn't show enough to prove themselves a viable scalp. Hate that. That basically means that The only wins that are meaningful are in competitive fights, when actually we know that's not the case. Anyone who suggests that doesn't really know what they're talking about. It's that idea that, you know, oh, unless it's really close, that guy down that night might not have been that good. There's previous fights, form, you know, skill distribution against similar opponents or opponents with similar tools that you can use to prove that, oh, okay, it's not because they're useless and they're not a good win. It's because this guy had a really great night. To dismiss that seems sort of narrow-minded. But in this particular instance, we know that Cyril Garn isn't very good at these things, and that's why John Jones was able to breeze by him so easily. If John Jones, who has previously been somewhat of a tepid kickboxer in some of his bouts, and I used those examples, his last sort of three fights at 205... if he had won a five-round striking battle with Garn and absolutely pissed it, showing off great defence, you know, checked his kicks, beat him, landed the harder shots, that actually is the kind of thing where you're saying, oh, okay, in terms of competitiveness, that makes this a better win. If Jones had to do that because he tried to wrestle Garn and Garn showed improvement, was able to fight off his takedown attempts, force him into his wheelhouse, and then John Jones won, that's where you go, oh, okay, the competitiveness there proves that that was a great scalp. But Jones just run over him in a way we know, and in phases of a bout where we know Garn is poor. You know, I've seen a lot of people this morning, some people I really respect and some people I've never seen before, maybe I'll grow to respect, but I doubt it, saying he's proved it, he's come back after 3 years, won the second bout, and, you know, he is the greatest of all time. I hate to stick on this, but George St. Pierre come back after 4 years and beat someone who was better at MMA for a bout, a real bout. And I think that's what we got. That's more important. You might say that due to the weight span that Jones, you know, he actually climbed more weight, essentially. I get that as well. If you want to make that argument, not one I'd go for. There's nuance to this. It's just the best. I'm sorry to get hung up on this particular comparison, but if we're looking at the achievement based on bout in a second weight class, time off, the GSP Bisping fight is the comparison to make. GSP Bisping was more competitive because Bisping is better at MMA than Garn. Bisping was definitely in a worse physical state than Garn. He just had the up and down fight with Dan Anderson and probably only had one eye. And he was able to make a better fight of it with GSP. So GSP, you know, essentially had a closer fight with a guy who was in a worse condition than Garn. But then Bisping's way better at MMA than Garn. And that was, regardless of what you think about the competition at the time at 185, not getting a look in due to Bisping sort of going on a veterans tour, that was the real middleweight title, the lineal middleweight championship. This is not the lineal heavyweight championship, unless you're going on some notion that Garn should be rightful champ by way of robbery. Fight was weird and close. I spoke about on Heavy Hands, weird close fight, and not really worthy of pure robbery in my opinion. But either way, if that's the guy who's your main heavyweight champion, it's still not that impressive. The lineage, in my opinion, does make it a more impressive achievement. But, and as I say, the lineage at middleweight was not indicative of the state of middleweight. You know, if GSP had stuck around, he probably would have lost to Whitaker. I mean, he would have been murdered against Yael Romero. That doesn't matter. The achievement is what matters. If we're comparing achievements, Bisping was better at MMA. He was more dangerous to GSP with his historically good takedown defence, get-up ability and kickboxing skill than Garn was with his pure striking, which we know you can take him out of his game. You know, he's at his most potent when he's not just sort of being lulled into a fainting battle. And he was so scared of the grappling here, that's basically all we had. So, yes, I'm well aware that Jones came back after a long time off, and I'm well aware that Garn is in his physical prime, but forgive me for thinking that GSP's win over Bisping is way more impressive. I'm also well aware that for many of my listeners, the whole GOAT debate is a waste of time, but just trying to respond to the sort of purveying conversation that I'm seeing today, and that's it. You know, it's not just Jones won the bout, it's Jones won the bout, and look how amazing he is. Well, I'm glad that Jones has shown some sort of return to form. That's good to see. Regardless of your opinion on him personally, he is one of the all-time greats of MMA, and it was a bit depressing watching his last couple bouts at £205. They're probably lining him up to fight Stipe Miocic next. Stipe hadn't fought for a while, got smashed last time, and is past his best. But if he can have any sort of form, I don't think he'll be able to pull the trigger, Stipe. Just got the feeling. Even in that third Cormier fight, he looked sluggish. Cormier just looked more sluggish. That's my opinion. I think the second Cormier fight was when he last looked fucking really good. He's had a long career, Stipe. He's like, what, 40 now? Top bloke. If he can be 75% of what he was in his prime, with his defensive wrestling ability and striking, should provide a stern test for John Jones. But pretty sure John Jones is going to run over him, just because, you know, basically I'm the same sort of internal debate I've had with Miocic I'm having with Jones. You know, last time we saw him, he didn't look good and he hadn't fought for a while. What sort of fighter is he going to be? Well, with Jones, there was always that idea that, you know, he's not really had that hard a career and he's his own worst enemy. If he can sort that out, he should be all right. You know, he's stagnated. Miocic isn't going to get any better. it can only get worse. So my assumption is that there's no real big questions, and he's going to be, if not a shell of him, well, he will be a shell of himself. He might not be a complete shell, but he's not going to be anywhere near he was in his prime. So I should think that Jones will smash him to bits. And I have no idea whether someone like Pavlovich can even stand up to him in terms of defensive grappling. He's just a striker. May he bop one of the greatest chins of all time early. Maybe it's 4 ounce gloves and heavyweight. But yeah, I don't really see any stiff tests for John Jones. So the reason I'm saying all this is this sort of conversation is going to be ongoing. And for a long time, it was John Jones is the GOAT. And if you don't agree, you don't really know what you're talking about. And actually, I think there's a much more nuanced debate to be had. Maybe not for this podcast, though, maybe for another one. But I think in terms of the John Jones conversation, we've got a bit more to add to it now. We've got a bit more data. He's interesting to talk about again. Hence why I've just spent 20 minutes on him. So that's a good thing. And I hope, if I have any new listeners, you don't think I'm sort of hedging against Jones and running his opposition down before he's had a chance to beat him, or this is some sort of way for me to reclaim face and saying that Jones hasn't added to his legacy. It's not the case. I rank John Jones amongst the top 5 or 6 greatest fighters of all time. That's a very high ranking indeed. You're splitting hairs when you get to that sort of level. Still think it's an impressive win to beat Gunn. That he, you know, at this stage of his career, he can still cut through someone with those sort of deficiencies easily, because that's not always the case. Some people just, you know, there could be a time where, you know, you're completely shot and someone like Gunn just pushes you off easily. You're completely depleted athletically. This just does show a level of longevity for Jones that's impressive, that you don't tend to see with fighters that burn bright early. You know, very much Jones was brilliant right out the gate, tapered off after some excellent defences, and looked very much like a veteran fighter who was past his best. The fact that he can still do this at this stage after time out of the sport, that's good. That's definitely good, and it adds to his legacy. It doesn't make him the de facto greatest of all time. That's all I'm saying. This is not a case of me going, oh, fuck it, he's beaten Garn. How can I figure out a way to make it not that impressive? Or, God, he's going to have a long, dominant run at heavyweight. I better run him down now. No, just going based on what I see, my own opinions, based on the facts of these fighters and the ebb and flow of their bouts, assessing them fairly. If you're new to the podcast, apologies if I'm not talking about your favourite fighter as you want me to. And if you're a long-time listener to the podcast, I'm sure you'll know that I just feel disappointed that John Jones wasn't as brilliant as he was, and as exciting, as innovative as he was, creative as he was in his early days. That's what I'm annoyed about. Yes, the stuff outside the cage annoys me and makes me not be a fan of his, not root for him, but to not be a fan of his fighting is a totally different thing. You can root against someone in a fight and still enjoy what they do in a fight, or fairly assess what they do in a fight. If you can't, then you probably shouldn't be talking about fights. I think, you know, if you're completely ruled by bias, not a good thing. So, yeah, me was not a fan of... Let me show you my sort of journey as a Jones fan. Massive fan pre-title. Rooted against him against Shogun because that was my favourite fighter at the time. A bit annoyed of him after that, but not his fault. But, you know, still amazing to watch him work. You know, he fucking pasted Machida and dissected everyone else. Gustafsson fight, I always thought he won that fight, to be honest with you. Maybe that's a one for right or robbery, but that's when you start to see cracks in him in terms of not being this dominant fighter, or rather that the outside life was starting to, you know, encroach on his in-cage abilities. After that, it's been a mixed bag. Some great performances, some not. Obviously, the DC one is the best performance of his career, in my opinion, based on what we knew going into that fight. That's the legacy builder. Garn don't come close. So yeah, this is like cherry on top stuff, really. But in terms of the current conversation with Jones, it's good that he won. It's good that we got something. I mean, if Garn had won, it's like, the UFC champion is someone who wasn't good enough to beat the guy they got rid of. This is what they banked on. This is what they banked on. People going, well, if Ngannou was here, Jones would just beat him anyway. Stupid people like that. And he might well do, but it's stupid to just assume. You can't crown someone based on what they might do, only what they have done. That's what the UFC's banked on. They've banked on Jones beating someone in a better fashion than Ngannou, so people forget that the real champ's gone. And with 90% of the rhetoric I've seen today online, small sample size, admittedly, it has worked. I hope and pray that my listenership are not as easily swayed, and I'm almost certain that's the case. But obviously, as always, if you want to have a discussion about it, hit me up on Twitter at @combatcr. Plenty more to talk about on this card right after this commercial break.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back. We're still talking about UFC 285. Of course, Alexa Grasso defeating Valentina Shevchenko for the UFC 125-pound women's belt. I'm not going to talk about this at length, but it is interesting, the dynamic here and how it played out. Grasso, I've never been particularly fond of, bit of a decision merchant. In the division as painful as this, that can make it even more arduous to sit through. But she has chipped away, she has improved, and she managed to hold her own here, and that's why she was able to win this belt. And Shevchenko, we know that most of her opposition are so far below her and get so overawed by the potential to be cracked by one of her well-timed shots, be it wrestling or striking, that they go into a shower. And when you go into a shower at Shevchenko, she doesn't amp it up and go, fuck it, I'll get rid of you. You're a level below me. You're two levels below me. She just starts fucking around, basically. And her fights are painful to sit through. I'm sure there'll be listeners who are big fans of Shevchenko and respect her for what she's done. I certainly respect her for what she's done, but I just don't find her very interesting to talk about. That's all I'm trying to say. Grasso did not let her fight at her own pace. When she was grounded, she was constantly trying to scramble, constantly making Shevchenko work. And on the feet, she was chipping away. She was very basic sort of southpaw pressure boxing. Kept her hands up, was able to jab with Val at points, but mainly trying to time those bursts. And in the end, she timed one of those bursts, got her back quite easily. And before that, actually, let's go into a little bit more depth than I was intending to. Shevchenko did look worn. She looked tired. The strikes and the shots by the fourth round were way off. Grasso was, you know, easy to take down in the early going, apart from one of Shevchenko's patented head and arm throws that don't always work. But, you know, the reactive double was there often, and then she'd have to work constantly to work her way back to her feet. But that was chipping away at Shevchenko and depleting and emptying the tank a bit, you know what I mean? But come by the fourth round, Grasso was quite easily able to stuff the takedown attempts. You know, getting over a hook, getting under a hook, and just push Shevchenko back. And then Val just started looking tired. And then the striking started to look desperate. Then she was unable to dominate a range like she usually does. She was unable to time her opponents as she usually does. And she just started looking ragged. And fair play to her. She really tried to fight through the face crank that ended it. I spoke last week about early contenders for the sort of finish of the year awards next year. I'm already thinking about it. This one, we're 3 months into the year. This one's going to be on there, given who it was against, how it sort of went against. Well, I think the ebb and flow was favouring Grasso by this point. I think if she'd not finished Val in this round, I think she probably would have won the fifth round based on how Shevchenko was looking. And then we're talking about one of those three rounds. Did she land enough to, because she did land some sharp punches early on. She was able to time Val as she come forward and crack her with 1-2s and whatnot. So we're then thinking, is this a 10-8? Have we got a draw? Did she win one of them early rounds? And she could have won anyway, but as it stands, doesn't matter at all. Got the finish, and fair play to her, new champ. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, as much as this throws a spanner into the works at 125, and it's kind of, I don't know if it's the right word, but sort of serendipitous that I've started talking about 125 women's on the last episode. Keep talking about the last episode. I guess because I haven't done an episode so long, I've got nothing to refer to. But Blanchfield, you know, she's now an interesting fighter at 125. I think Shevchenko's going to get the Nunes tax and we'll get an immediate rematch. But, this makes the division more interesting. From a technical standpoint, not a huge amount to talk about. Val does what Val does. And Grasso just stayed patient, just chipped away, kept consistent. The striking is relatively basic, but it was the intangibles. It was the pressure. It was the stamina. It was everything which other Shevchenko opponents haven't had. That poise, the ability to stay focused in the moment that allowed her to pressure Val down the stretch and eventually got her the win. Some nice little technical bits in there, but nothing to write home about. It's just, you know, it's good for women's 125. This idea that, you know, Shevchenko, she was so far above her opponents, but this idea that she's one of the greatest of all time, I've never been on board with that. Sure, some people will. For me personally, not my bag. Just draw a line under the sand for this part of her career. Let's see how she responds. That will certainly be a legacy builder for her. She's now got a rival, essentially. If she can turn back Grasso and eventually beat Blanchfield, then we're talking about a fighter who's great. It's kind of the John Jones beating Garn thing. You know, Shevchenko beating Lauren Murphy doesn't impress me. Sorry. Her losing to Grasso, based on what we know of Grasso before, as a bit of a decision merchant and someone who's very much a work in progress, at the moment it's a bit of an indictment on Shevchenko. But she'll have a chance, no doubt, to get that win back. And good luck to her. I will cover her now. No, she's not boring me. From a champion, it's often left me underwhelmed, to a prospect, as it gets better and better every time I see him. Shavkat Rakhmonov defeating Jeff Neal, the dependable Jeff Neal, by standing RNC in the third round. This was an absolute banger, basically, from start to finish. It feels like a gut check fight for a 170 prospect, much as Gilbert Burns and Khamzat Chimaev was. Rakhmonov did have to come through some fire. Nothing like that fight. But I think we've learned a lot about him as a fighter. Some good, some bad. Mainly in the positive, as I say. He impresses me more and more. The more I see him against different styles of fighter, the more he stepped up. Jeff Neal's really good in the pocket. Rakhmonov excelled there. Definitely some defensive issues. He's quite upright, quite stiff. He likes to double up on the rear end, you know, kind of walk forward, double up on the right hand, try and move you around, try and catch you off guard, try and change the tempo of that shot. Tends to work. In the third round, we see him do it. It leaned up the third round. He started really working his beautiful right hand to the body. You know, he couldn't really win the lead hand battle with Jeff Neal in the open stance matchup. He was closing distance better with kicks and with knees. But, you know, he really did find a spot for that right uppercut to the body. In the third round, he does it with no setup whatsoever and walks into a big counter combo and he's on rubber legs. So there is some things to work out in that regard. He's a bit upright. Does like to keep his hands sort of around nipple height and a bit lower. Will bring him up as he punches, which is great, but concedes ground a little bit. Hate to say it because he's a Kazakh, but, you know, the Kazakh boxing sort of style, but a bit like Golovkin in the case of he's better at, he will concede ground sometimes when you throw at him backwards in a straight line rather than practically moving his head or keeping his hands up, you know. And that gives you a chance to reset. So Rachmanov, though, really excellent pressure fighter. As I say, love the way he closes distance with kicks and knees. Excellent clinch fighter. Always fighting to create separation. Always fighting grips. Excellent in that regard. Neil, lovely pocket boxer. But Rachmanov able to meet him with knees, elbows, fighting him off in that range as well. So I thought really Rachmanov passed every test, even though Jeff Neal had his moments, because someone like Jeff Neal is going to have moments. We can't see uncompetitive fights at this level. The fact that Rachmanov passed that test, beating Neal or competing with Neal, actually I think he did beat him in all phases of the fight, but obviously there were moments when Neal really did shine brightly. But really, Rachmanov came through the stamina test, he came through the chin test, he came through the range test, he came through the pocket test, he came through the grappling test, every single test he passed, and then finishes him late on in the third round. So for me, the fact it was competitive only makes Shavkat Rachmanov look better. As I say, just as a fighter, love how he operates in the clinch, love the kicks. I think, you know, even in the open stance matchup, that right leg of his is just an immense weapon. I do think that someone longer, more defensively responsible than Neil might be able to test him even more on the feet, because, as I say, bit stiff, bit upright, a little bit straight on at times. But all in all, excellent performance. And yes, that sort of holy trinity of 170-pound prospects, Kamzat Chimaev, he might not even be able to make the weight. Jack Della Maddalena, who's not had that big test yet that Chimaev and Rachmanov have had. And obviously, Shavkat Rachmanov. They make the division look great going forward. But, you know, JDM hasn't had that test, as I say. Chimaev might not make 170 again, much I'd love him to be able to do so. It might well be that Shavkat Rachmanov is the coming man at 170. So once we get this Leon Edwards-Kamaru Usman rubber match out of the way, I think, you know, there's a couple other fights that Rachmanov can take at 170. And I think he's ready. He's basically ready. Jeff Neal was, what, 7th, 8th in the division, coming off career best win over Luque. I think, you know, Rachmanov's there. You know, you've got someone like Bilal Muhammad who's proven himself and ready for a title shot. But he's, you know, that's a fight filler. That's a title fight filler. That's someone who's just sort of worthy of a shot. I don't think he's actually a legitimate, even in a favourable styles match, a real legitimate title challenger. He's just been around for a while. He's putting together a really good run. Shavkat Rachmanov, in my opinion, he could be a legitimate elite fighter. He looks like it. If you were to put him with Leon Edwards tomorrow, I think Leon would definitely have his moments. He wouldn't have his moments. He'd have his opportunities. Of course, Leon Edwards is going to have moments, but I just feel like Rachmanov, he fills that space so well. He's always on top of you. I would probably pick him to beat Leon Edwards by decision, even though Leon has so many goods, and obviously he might not beat Usman in a rubber match. This is just spitballing. But even though he's able to do things to counteract what Rachmanov does well, you know, he's also an excellent clinch fighter. He's also so good at framing off. He's also excellent with kicks, knees, elbows. That's Leon's thing, you know. Just feel like Rachmanov does those things, but sets a faster pace. I just, you know, my battles with Leon as a fighter are well documented on this podcast, but just feel like Rachmanov could win a decision against him, not easily by any means, but I just feel like he does things well that can allow him to compete with Leon where other people can't. And I just feel like he's very much the coming man in terms of how he puts all those things together and the output that he's shown he could have. I don't know how he'd... I can see what he does to counteract wrestling and whatnot. So I know he's got that up his sleeve, but I don't know how he'd fight against Usman. That's my big thing. If Usman won the title, then I might think, okay, if Kamaru Usman's still got it and he's not shot or anything, I'm not sure how Rachmanov would deal with that sort of dominant wrestler type. But hey, you know, he's shown everything so far that makes me feel like he's got the skills to be an all-round force. And if Chimaev can't make 170 again, he's legitimately the best prospect at the weight, in my opinion. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, if Leon Edwards wins again, the prototypical 170-pound wrestle boxer isn't really around, so wouldn't be necessarily concerned for Rachmanov going forward. But yeah, not necessarily certain that he'd fail that test, but that's just the thing. I'm not 100% sure yet. But yeah, so far, for everyone who can try and grapple with him, he has passed with flying colours. Looks like an excellent clinch fighter, and as a range finder as well. You know, as I say, he lost the jab really today. He was kind of hand fighting with Neil, wasn't really able to establish the jab too often. But yeah, backed it up and adapted, started landing with the kicks instead. So with the open side kick, brilliant work, nice adaptation. I just think he passed with flying colours. Apologies for actually getting excited about a fighter for once, but Rakhmanov's it. And as for Jeff Neal, still quality, good performance. You know, I feel like the Wonderboy fight kind of made me so low on Jeff Neal. Everything before and after that in recent times, he's been really, really fucking good. So, yeah, Jeff Neal, match him like a winner. He didn't make weight. I think he will next time. Didn't look, you know, strained or anything in the fight. He looked fine. And Dana White, in a rare, decent move, gave Jeff Neal a bonus as well. I hope Rakhmanov got looked after behind the scenes also, because I think they're going to want to take care of him going forward, because this guy looks like a fucking serious, serious talent. And I pray, and I'm an atheist, but I pray that Chimaev can sort his life out, make 170, because can you imagine if either one of them wins the bout and we get this undefeated Chimaev Rakhmanov fight? You'd be fucking lying if you wouldn't, if you say you're not excited for that. I think that'd be one of the most intriguing, I think it would be almost like a super fight. You know, you can say, like, oh, God, stop drinking the Kool-Aid, Kyle. But at the end of the day, like, how often do you get two super prospects, essentially, that are both undefeated, fighting for a belt in a division that's been starved of new talent for a while? Do you know what I mean? Like, these two both look at 170, not unbeatable, but fucking scary. And the fact you would... I hate to say it, because welterweight in boxing is not MMA, but the comparison I'm thinking of is another welterweight fight, and it's Felix Trinidad and Oscar De La Hoya. That's the kind of feels I would get from a fight between Chimaev and Rakhmanov. But it's all about, you know, can Chimaev make the weight? I hope he can. Wonderful bit of Joe Rogan analysis as well in this fight. Shavkat's tall. Thanks for that, Joe. Cheers. I'll tell you who is tall for the weight. Jalen Turner. And maybe this part of the podcast will be most surprising, but I'm actually more sold on Jalen Turner as a prospect after his loss to Matheus Gamrot in this bout. I think the kind of feeling I saw online going into this was the, you know, Turner's a bit of a hot prospect that hasn't really been tested. And Gamrot's a guy who's basically on fraud watch. And when I say that, I'm not saying the guy's a fraud. He's clearly a very capable fighter. I've covered him on this podcast a couple of times before. But really, could be, even after this fight, 0-3 in his last three, in my opinion. I think Sarukian clearly beat him. Beneil Dariush clearly beat him. That's obvious, and he did beat him. And I think Jalen Turner actually deserved to win this fight. I'm not saying it's a robbery, like a Sarukian fight. And I'm not saying that Gamrot didn't do anywhere near as badly as he did in the Dariush fight. But for me, based on the scoring criteria, I think that Turner landed the sharper, more impactful blows throughout. I think there are obviously things to work on. Let's talk about what he's got to work on. Let's talk about the scoring first. But I think that Gamrot definitely in the first round did land some ground and pound as Turner was trying to post up. And in the second round, right near the end with the crucifix, landed some ground and pound. It wasn't massively impactful, but obviously there was a lot of it, you know, and it looks, optics-wise, if you're in a crucifix position and getting pounded on, you know, you can argue for that not to be important to scoring. But even in the third round, didn't do much with the control and, you know, looking up at the clock, running around, Turner landing sharp counter blows with that long frame of his, all seemed to bother Gamrot throughout. And, yeah, for me, I think Turner could have easily won two rounds. I think 30-27 Gamrot, although I could kind of see how you could bend that way if you wanted to. Pretty egregious in my opinion. But aside from the scoring, Gamrot sort of stays top 10. We know his ceiling now. We know what he brings to the table. I think based on this fight, he's a pretty perfect gatekeeper. Took this at late notice. Pretty meat and potatoes as a striker. Can sort of, you know, strike from either stance, but pretty basic stuff. Pretty darn good wrestler. Not an amazingly versatile finisher or anything like that, but, you know, he can wrestle, he can strike a bit, he's a good all-rounder, really is a jack-of-all-trades master of none, in my opinion. Need a bit more at lightweight to go to the top, but also, if you can't get through that kind of fighter at lightweight, you don't deserve to get to the top. So, harsh as it sounds, at 155, very much still a gatekeeper. I wonder if he could still make 145, where he used to be. But for Turner, actually did better at fighting off some of the takedown attempts, or at least, you know, regaining his footing afterwards. Showed the ability to try and post up and desperately trying to get his back to the cage. But, you know, that's what you got to do. And I think, you know, some of the silly mistakes he made, like I think it was the first round or the second round, which is sort of, he was on the front foot doing really well, peppering Gamrot with shots, stinging him, then throws a naked low kick and just gets taken down. Or in the third round where Gamrot's sort of fighting him on a single and he tries to hit him with a flying knee. Looks great. Be amazing if it comes off, highlight reels, etc., etc. But in terms of functional output and ways of, you know, defending bad positions, not great. So Turner, actually, all the physical ability in the world, now can see what he's got to work on to take that next step, in my opinion. Whereas for me, Gamrot, his ceiling is very much clear. With Turner, I know people were hoping to see him tested. He's now lost this fight. Maybe people were going, ah, he's not as good as we thought. Actually, I think there's a lot to take from, a lot of positives to take from this one, and he now knows what he needs to work on. So, well up for seeing both of these guys match as winners going forward. Maybe we'll see him fight again down the line. Pretty compelling matchup. I did enjoy it. Just thought Turner deserved to win the fight. I thought he landed the cleaner blows throughout. And when Gamrot did get him in bad positions, which was quite regular over the three rounds, wasn't able to do enough with it to sort of counteract the times he was clearly stung, sort of looked like a couple flash knockdowns here and there, or bundled over. The optics of that are also bad, but we just still seem to favour takedowns, control, and a bit of ground and pound that doesn't get someone in a terrible state. We still seem to favour that. We still seem to, judges still seem to think of that as, you know, being important to win a round. We still hear the UFC commentators say, oh, he's won the round with that takedown. We're fucking 10 years in the past, mate. We're 15 years in the past. Come on now, we've got to do better. One young prospect who shouldn't need much of an introduction, but Bo Nickel, excellent All-American wrestler. Regardless of what you think of his first opponent here, and I think I've said before that I don't particularly rate Jamie Pickett. The fact of the matter is, for Nickel to blast through him so quickly in just his fourth bout, really impressive. Such a slick back take. Just excellent stuff. He did have to fight for the takedown, but he's got a lot to work on, I'm sure. But to be beating a fighter like this, who's an actual, like, you know, bit of veteran, being around the block a little bit, and Pickett easily in just his fourth bout shows to me that, talk about hot prospects, talked about earlier with Rakhmanov and Chimaev, at 185, Bo Nickel's the man. So really great stuff. Check it out. It was quick, didn't take long, and very, very slick stuff. Hopefully it'll be out again in the next month or so. Don't know how bad his cut is to 185. He's fucking wrestled all over the shop, I think, from like 170 or up to 200 pounds there about. So I'm not sure how much he cuts. Doesn't look humongous, so hopefully he can make it, or even just give him someone shit at 205 in the interim. I don't really care. Just get him out regularly, get him more cage experience. We know he's got some raw power from one of his earlier fights, and yeah, clearly got just insane athletic level and should progress pretty quickly. Like 170, 185 is a division that's been long crying out for prospects, and Bo Nickel should be pushed, given this is a UFC debut and it's on a pay-per-view card as the opener. He's going to get a massive push, going to have plenty of opportunities to do it. Not a huge amount to talk about. Obviously, I'm not a grappling expert, but stuff online, if you want to check people out, I would have retweeted it this morning anyway. So, but yeah, just check it out. It's well worth a watch, and Bo Nickel looks to be absolutely shit hot. It's kind of thing where, like, if you can teach him a bit more, say Pereira beats Adesanya, if you get Nickel a couple of fights in the interim, just a bit more experience based on his grappling acumen, you wouldn't say, no, we can't beat Pereira, he's just too, he's levels above him. We've got a fucking striking specialist who's the champion, And Nichols going to fucking easily out-grapple him unless he gets his fucking head taken off. That's the same for basically anyone. It doesn't matter what level or stage of his career he's at. Bo Nichol would have as good a chance of out-grappling Pereira and as good a chance as anyone else of getting his head taken off. It doesn't matter that he's a prospect. You could fucking put him in a title fight and he might win. Did appear quite ropey and a bit sloppy on the feet. Can't do that against Pereira. You will get your fucking head knocked into Rosette, but or Rosie, as my American listeners might call it. But yeah, fucking, if you, again, acting like I'm not excited about him as a prospect, and to act that I'm sort of too cool for school, it's bullshit. I'm massively excited that UFC have got one of these top prospects. Bellator seems to snap up so many intriguing sort of wrestlers and foreign prospects nowadays that for them to grab Bo Nichol and be pushing him and for we have someone potentially intriguing at 185 pounds, yes, I'm fucking excited. Absolutely. Talk about 185 from the prelims. Dricus du Plessis versus Derek Brunson was absolute car crash. Must watch stuff. Check it out immediately. Lovely stuff indeed. Just absolute slobber knocker in terms of just awfulness. Loved it. Really, really good stuff. Cody Garbrandt, still not sold on him at all. Sold any sort of renaissance anyway is what I mean. You know, obviously he's had his moment in the sun. Beat Trevin Jones, had a couple of dodgy moments towards the end there, but yeah, all in all, pretty routine stuff. But as soon as he fights someone that can bang again, he'll get wiped out. There could be no doubt about that. So look forward to that happening at some point. Again, don't hate the guy by any means, but he's most fun when he's in shootouts that he can either bang someone out in or get banged out himself. We know his level by now. And talking about tall prospects, can't finish a podcast without talking about Ian Garry, a guy I've not been sold on, but has slowly started to impress me. Not sold on Song Kanan really as a fighter at all, so I don't particularly care in that regard. But what Garry showed in terms of his poise, his ability to get out of the way, counter, lead as well as counter, the way he's putting his shots together, the way he's varying up his strikes, starting to come round to him. Still don't think he's this, what they call him, the future. So not really sold on him as that. I remember before his pro debut, one prominent writer slash podcaster, I won't name because I really like this person, but said, you know, Garry's got pro world title potential. Never sold on that. Certainly haven't been in his first couple of fights, but really starting to put it together. Clinical stuff. Stayed sharp throughout, got the finish towards the end of the third round. Yeah, very much impressed by the performance. Look forward now to seeing him work his way through and progress his way up the ladder. There's lots of interesting fights for him. You know, under the tutelage of Henry Hooft and those guys at Sanford, Black Zillions, whatever the fuck's it called now. What's it called now? Hold on, it's going to stop while I check. Of course, Killcliff FC. I mean, definitely the worst name they've come up with yet. But yeah, under the tutelage of those guys, he's just getting better and better. And although I'm not sold on the opponent, pretty one-route stuff in that regard. Cannot knock the performance. So I will always say when I'm wrong on this podcast, I'm not completely sold on Ian Garry yet. But he's definitely a more interesting prospect than I originally gave him credit for. And I think that's fair to say. I think that'll do it for this week. So don't know when this feed will be back, but be sure to check out the Combat Chronicles Patreon at www.patreon.com/combatchronicles, where I'm dropping stuff pretty regularly. Get a couple bonus episodes a month on there, some shorter than others, some longer than others, but always try and provide some weird and wonderful content over there, looking at more niche subjects than you might find on this free feed, so be sure to check that out. Until you hear me again, be it on Patreon or on this feed, have a good one. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate it. And peace out.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.